Hello. Once again, welcome to the Gratuitous Pausing Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Greyhawk.
And I'm your co-host, Jackson Eflin.
This week, we have Lady and the Tramp up against Wreck-It Ralph.
It's not our silliest mashup, that's next week, but it's pretty close. So, Lady, a Cocker Spaniel, lives an idyllic collared life until her humans sideline her for an incoming baby. A stray, Tramp, warns her that she will be forgotten. But once the baby is born, they return to a happy stasis. But then, the parents go on vacation, leaving Aunt Sarah and her shitty cats to watch the baby. The cats start a fracas and blame it on the lady. Aunt Sarah muscles her, and she runs away, runs into Tramp, and he shows her the dangers and wonders of an uncolored life. She eventually decides to return home, only to be taken to the pound, whereupon she learns that Tramp really, really gets around. She returns home, disgraced and ashamed, rebuffing Tramp's attempts to apologize. But when a rat sneaks in and tries to eat the baby, Tramp helps Lady stop it. Tramp is forgiven, adopted, collared, and his puppies ever after.
100 years later, Ralph is the antagonist of an arcade game, Fix It Felix Jr., in which he damages an apartment building while Felix attempts to repair it. Ralph is ostracized by the other characters and is not invited to the 30th anniversary party for the game. He crashes the party, makes a mess, and vows to win a medal to earn the respect of Felix and the others. Ralph enters another game at the arcade, Hero's Duty. While he does get a medal there, he also launches himself and a cybug into a racing game, Sugar Rush. Meanwhile, without Ralph to do his job, Fix-It Felix Jr. is marked as out of order, and at risk of being unplugged. Felix leaves the game to find Ralph and to save their home. He teams up with Sergeant Calhoun from Hero's Duty, who is looking to destroy the escaped cybug before it destroys another game. In Sugar Rush, Ralph meets and befriends Vanellope, a glitch who wants to be a racer. Ralph helps her build a race cart and track to practice for the race. King Candy convinces Ralph to betray Vanellope in exchange for his lost medal. After some introspection, Ralph realizes his error and returns to free Felix from the Fungin and has him repair Vanellope's cart so she can enter the race. Vanellope zooms to the front of the pack and is attacked by King Candy. She escapes and King Candy is eaten by a cybug. Before Vanellope can finish the race and reset the game, cybugs overrun and destroy the finish line. Ralph realizes he can create a beacon to destroy the cybugs using the Diet Coke and Mentos volcano, and intends to sacrifice himself to save the others. Ralph triggers the eruption, but is saved by Vanellope and her teleporting glitch. Felix repairs the finish line, and Vanellope finishes the race, resetting the game and revealing she is the rightful ruler of Sugar Rush. Felix and Ralph return to their home game and prevent it from being unplugged. Felix and Calhoun marry. Ralph has finally earned the respect of the other characters.
So I'll let you pick the summaries for this week, and you inexplicably let me do Lady and the Tramp, a far simpler story. So thank you for taking on the heavy burden, the hero's duty of this saga.
You said duty.
God damn it. There were maybe 7 toilet jokes in Wreck-It Ralph, and that's about 8 too many for me. That's a ding against it, but I'll allow you that one. Ha ha, duty.
All right, before we get sidetracked, let's go ahead and talk about Lady and the Tramp.
Yeah. You know that bit where we go, wow, this movie's gorgeous? That thing.
The opening backgrounds for, like, them zooming in on the house during Christmas and kind of the bookend of the movie where they're zooming back out, those backgrounds are really pretty.
Mm-hmm. The animal animation is really good, too.
Mm-hmm. They do a really good job of portraying the time period. This is set somewhere in the early 1900s. There are cars, but there aren't many of them. They're still sharing the roads with horse-drawn carriages. A lot of the costuming design is like late 1800s, early 1900s. It was an interesting choice.
So guess where this is set, because I found that out, but where do you think it's set?
Well, upon initial viewing, I was thinking New York, but I don't know, there seemed to be a little bit too much easily accessible rural locales, so I'm not entirely sure.
Yeah, it's in the Midwest. That's all we know. It's the Midwest. Midwestern townia. A choice this movie made was to have various animals, especially the cats and dogs, be representative of various cultures from whence those animals originally came. So you have a beaver who's kind of Canadian. You have a Russian dog with a Russian accent.
You have an English bulldog who has a typical, like, Cockney accent. You've got a Scottish terrier that is Scottish. You have a bloodhound who sounds as if he is somewhere from the south.
And then there's,
Yeah, let's just go ahead and get into it. There's the Siamese cats.
And their name's Cy and Am, so that's the level of thought that went into this. The amount that there are blatant racist caricatures is pretty atrocious, and it's worse than you remembered, if you remember it all. There's, like, buck teeth. There's broken English. It's... ugh.
Yeah, they managed to get buck teeth on cats. It's some impressive effort to create a very harmful caricature.
Mm-hmm.
It goes without saying that this has not aged well. There's also some other immigrant caricatures throughout the film. None are nearly as blatantly bad, but it does kind of get a little uncomfortable at times.
Yeah, you have the ostensibly Irish cop and the ostensibly Italian chefs.
Mm-hmm. And the Irish cop has a rosy nose. I'm not entirely sure if that was intended to read as he might be inebriated while on the job, but with the track record this film has for racial sensitivity, I'm not gonna rule it out.
And the Italian family acts like a stereotypical Italian family, which also means that they're really great because this sort of stereotypical Italian family is a bunch of laughs. So it's still a problematic character, but it does give us Tony, who is a very lovable, fun character who goes through all this trouble to make spaghetti meatballs for these dogs and set them a little table and stuff. It's a cute scene.
Mm-hmm. There's also one other stereotype, the chihuahua, when Lady is locked up at the pound.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Yeah, that's kind of leading pretty heavily into the lazy Mexican stereotype there.
Mm-hmm. And his sister has a overly long name, and that's a bunch of a few jokes.
Yeah, there's a lot of racial and immigrant insensitivity in this film, and it's pretty unavoidable. There's a lot of intended humor that's supposed to be derived from it, and considering this film came out over 60 years ago at this point.
Yeah, pushing 70.
Those stereotypes aren't really considered in good taste.
I think the movie was trying to go for multicultural, and there was an attempt. Gold star. Hashtag you tried.
I don't think it is reasonable to give out a gold star to this movie.
Yeah.
There's also some other issues with it, like the gender and sexual politics of Lady. At one point, Jacques and Trusty go up to her and, well, obviously one of us has to marry her in order to get her out of the literal doghouse.
After her, like, shameful night with a poor guy. And admittedly, like, Lady is angry that Tramp has had other lady friends, but also she's treated as if she, like, had a scandalous affair. It feels like something from a Jane Austen book or something.
Yeah, there's also some weird pseudo-commentary on the criminal justice system. Tramp is falsely accused and sent to the pound.
And the pound... we do have that horrific scene where a dog is led away to be put down. There is some commentary there on how prisons are used to make the homeless population vanish. And again, there was an attempt.
I think barring all of the weirdness, though, the overall story is pretty decent.
Yeah, I'll admit I care about Lady as a character. A fun part of the film is that we see a lot of it from the dog's perspective, so we don't learn the names of her humans. They're just Jim Deere and Darling, because that's what they call each other, and that's really cute. And Lady doesn't really understand what's happening with this baby that's coming. She only has these signs, and then she explains them to Jock and Trusty, the neighborhood dogs, and they're like, oh, well, we're old. We know what's happening. And it's fun watching these wheels turn. This part of the story is kind of the first act or so feels the most coherent and good and wholesome because it's just this young dog trying to fit in with this family, and it's kind of cute. I'm going to say that when the baby is born, that's act two, so I can push the cats off into act two, and then it's fine. And then act one can be okay.
I would definitely say that act two kind of begins when the baby comes and Aunt Sarah shows up. Everything goes wrong when Aunt Sarah shows up.
That's true.
The main cast of characters... they're compelling, they have their own goals and personalities. I find most of them pretty interesting, and overall story arc is relatively compelling. It's nothing spectacular, but it's not like I got bored.
A thing that was really interesting for me was the themes of safety versus freedom. So Lady's House, Lady having a collar, is this epitome of safety, whereas Life Out with Tramp is this epitome of freedom. And both Tramp and Lady kind of oscillate between these two poles. And I think it's interesting that freedom can so easily slide into imprisonment and death, but safety is also entirely dependent on there being good people taking care of you in that safety. And while there's a more rebellious part of me that wishes that Lady and Tramp had just like ditched the family and gone off on their own and had more wild adventures, I get that the family returning to a whole at the end is a sweet and wholesome thing and a good resolution to these themes being explored, even if they're not explored all that well. I want to tell you all, listeners at home, the sordid tale of how this movie came to be. So, in 1937, Joe Grant draws some pictures of the dog that will become Lady in the future, and Disney's like, that's great, draw some more stuff, and he keeps drawing stuff, and it doesn't really go anywhere. He tries to add a plot, Disney doesn't really like it, it gets shelved. At some point, Joe Grant leaves Disney to pursue his own interests. Ward Green, the author of Happy Dan the Cynical Dog, publishes that in Cosmopolitan Volume 118 in 1945. Disney reads that and is like, wow, that's great. I'm going to buy this and you, and we're going to just smoosh these two things together. So they do. And Disney's like, hey, Ward Green, write a novelization of this so that we have something to tell the public about it. And Ward Green's like, cool, I'll do that. He writes his own thing, which is kind of a bit like what they're planning, but not really. And Disney has to radically alter the plot to fit this book that was written. And parts were added. I haven't been able to get a copy of it, so I don't know what all was in there. But Disney added the quintessential spaghetti scene with dogs kissing. But what I'm guessing you're really wondering is, where did the Siamese cats come in?
I guess.
They came in the original story by Joe Grant. Some of his drawings have those cats in there, which means that everybody could have stopped this. Joe Grant could have stopped this, Ward Green could have stopped this, Disney could have stopped this, Peggy Lee could have not sung that song, the directors, all three of them could have not had this happen, the story writers, all four of them could have not had this happen, Sonny Burke and Oliver Wallace, who wrote the music, could have not had this happen, Hillary and Hayley Duff could have not covered that in 2005 on Disney Mania 2, but all these people were like, yes, this is fine.
So, there's a shit list for all you folks.
The saddest part of it is that it's the best song in the movie. Maybe not best, but most catchy. It's the only one I remember. It's that, the horrible dog singing, and then he's a tramp.
Yeah. This film does not have a whole lot of endearing music.
No.
I think it's interesting how much characterization Disney created through accents. As far as the films that we've watched in this series so far, this is the oldest film that had that sort of accented voice work, and it adds a lot. I mean, there's only a 3-year difference between this and Cinderella, and there's a huge jump in just how much character is given away by the voice work.
Also, in Cinderella, you had a lot of animal characters. You had the mice, the dog, the horse, the cat. They were all very Looney Tunes-y, whereas here you have these pretty accurate-looking animals. Like, they look like someone just drew a picture of an animal and then made it move. And that's a pretty impressive art shift for that short amount of time. I mean, I get that Cinderella is more focused on the people than the animals, sort of, but to see that amount of progress is really impressive.
Part of the reason for that is they had to be able to very distinctly differentiate between different breeds of dog, especially since you had so many dog characters. It was a very easy way to have this character and this character look and sound very different.
Was this the first furry access point Disney movie?
It's definitely before Robin Hood. It's before 101 Dalmatians. It's before Jungle Book. Probably?
So it has first finding out you're a furry movie and then first movie film cinemascope for Disney animated features.
Yeah, I think we've exhausted all there is to talk about this film. Moving on to a very different film, Wreck-It Ralph. Wreck-It Ralph is actually really interesting because as we're recording this, later this year, it's getting a sequel. Specifically a theatrically released sequel, which is a first in the Disney canon. So it had to have done something right.
I think it did something right in that it managed to be very widely appealing. If you're really into first-person shooters, you have Heroes Duty. If you're more into kids and kid games, you have Sugar Rush. If you're more the nostalgia of gaming, you have Fix-It Felix Jr. and also all of the various game characters that are in there. Something something Ready Player One joke.
I was actually pretty impressed with the amount of cameos that they were able to fit in. I mean, you've got Kong, Qbert, Bowser, Daisy and Rosalina from the Mario series, Sonic the Hedgehog, Dr. Eggman, Zangief, Bison from Street Fighter. Quite a few well-known characters that are in the movie that really add to the atmosphere and help build the world.
You have Sonic the Hedgehog on this video kiosk thing, explaining to both the people in the station and also to the audience that if you die outside your game, you die in real life. And it's done in the same style as those Sonic the Hedgehog consent PSAs from the 90s. And I'm like, ha, that's a good reference. That's funny. I think that's a good use of your Sonic to both convey information to the audience, but also give a nice little nod to everybody else.
I think one of the most impressive things about this film, especially since you have so many different characters coming together, and even the characters that they created for this film from these very different games, all feel different and distinct, but they don't clash with each other. It's very easy to tell the type of game that Calhoun comes from as opposed to Ralph and Felix, as opposed to Vanellope. But when they're on screen, they all feel like they can exist in the same world, even if they are very, very distinctly from completely separate worlds.
And that's kind of my favorite part of the movie, seeing these interactions between these wildly different genres of games. Felix of Fix-It Felix Jr. and Sergeant Calhoun of Hero Earth Duty spend most of the film together, and they bounce off each other really well. When they wind up getting married, it makes sense because they have this relationship built up. They're really funny because Sergeant Calhoun is this epitome of hardened alien fighting warrior tank, whereas Fix-It Felix is this incredibly wholesome, gentle creature who even his swears would be antiquated in the 50s. Seeing those two work together but also clash in how different they are is delightful and charming.
There's a lot of complex themes in this film too. I mean, when we're first starting off, Ralph is kind of telling his whole story to a room of other bad guys, and you find out that Ralph is the victim of gentrification. They're not terribly subtle about that either. They move his stump to the trash dump, and then they build an apartment building where his stump used to be. He has a legitimate grievance.
I'll agree, and I think another part of that is that his journey is trying to figure out how to express his grievance in a way that is constructive, because he initially tries to fit in with these people and it doesn't work because they have the separation. Then he tries to be someone else, and there's the slight weirdness of him like taking someone else's job, but anyway, whatever. He tries to be somebody else and that doesn't work, and it's only by understanding his vital role in the system and how his unique skill set can help people that he's able to actually fit in with people.
I actually had a couple issues with that whole finding your station in life. There's a lot of subtly malicious themes of accepting your lot in life, not trying to change things, and in a way accepting injustice.
I agree with that, and I think that the themes are definitely messy, but a thing that I liked was that Ralph realized that he had this massive trash heap of infinite bricks and can sort of generate them at will. And by making friends with Felix, he was able to say, hey Felix, use your building powers to make a house for all these homeless game characters from games that were unplugged. And I think that while you're right about the accepting your lot in life themes being messy, I think finding a way to make your lot in life work for the betterment of everybody is cool. On a sort of different level, there are a lot of myths where you have the creator and destroyer who have to kind of work in harmony with each other. So you have that with Felix and Ralph. And while I'm not sure they're necessarily going for a cyclical mythology thing, that theme kind of works for me in that both are necessary for the universe to exist, I guess. But I think that that works better when you have like actual deities or mythic figures.
Butting off of this topic, there's also very much this theme that good and bad are not strictly tied to law and authority. You have Ralph, who is distinctly not any sort of law or authority, but he has a legitimate grievance. He may not go about trying to remedy that grievance in a constructive way by trying to destroy the apartment building that was built on where he used to live, but there is some credence to why he is doing what he's doing. And additionally, later in the film, you have King Candy, who usurps power from another person and then uses said power to prevent Vanellope from being able to restore the natural order of things. And King Candy is probably the most evil character in the film.
You're right, but also on the other hand, in Hero's Duty, you have the army fighting these alien bugs, and the authority of that army and their right to destroy these bugs is never really questioned. To be fair, we spend the least time in Hero's Duty and exploring those themes or those characters, so the theme is a bit muddied. I see what they're going for. I'm not sure if it always worked.
There's also the complicated matter that the Cybugs are literally just a destructive force of nature. They just eat and destroy. They are not like the other antagonists in games where it's just a job, and then at the end of the day, they go and do whatever they feel like doing as opposed to fighting good guys. So again, the themes are a little muddied.
Which, to be fair, they've constructed three complete worlds and a linking meta world and a world for it all to exist within. And they're trying to work all those themes while also having a variety of character growth and mystery plot elements all worked through in about 2 hours. I get that not all the themes are going to be perfect. And honestly, the sequel sounds good because I want to see some of these themes explored more.
And getting back to just how complex the whole world is, the narrative is also very complex. It was quite a bit of a challenge to get the synopsis down to as short as I got it. This movie has a lot going on, and not all of it is strictly necessary, but there's not a whole lot that I would cut.
I think one thing I would cut, which is also a bit that was cut from your synopsis, spoilers if you haven't seen it. King Candy convinces Ralph not to help Vanellope because the game might be unplugged, and as a glitch, she wouldn't be able to leave and she'd be destroyed with the game. And that creates a relatively complicated antagonist who appears to want what's best for his subjects, and it creates an interesting moral question. Later, you find out that King Candy is actually Turbo, a character from another game that escaped and went rogue, and if the game was unplugged, he would also die outside of his game and therefore die in real life. Because of this, it creates a less complex villain and adds a layer of complexity to the world and to the character that I don't think actually helps the narrative in any way. I don't need him to be Turbo. I can just let him be a bad king. I mean, I love Disney princess films. I am fine with evil rulers.
There is also the fact that this film does give us our first Jewish Disney princess,
who actually stops being a princess at the end of the film and institutes constitutional democracy as a royal edict, and she elects herself president. So there's that. She's trying. She's like 8.
I think the other strongest themes in this film probably come from Ralph's surrogate fatherhood to Vanellope.
Probably. You should elaborate on that. I don't care about fathers in movies. That's not fair. I'll admit that I care the least about Ralph of any of the characters, so there's that.
I do think it's interesting that Ralph does take on this surrogate father role for Vanellope. I think it's useful to have Ralph's healing process begin with helping someone else, and specifically making it so that Vanellope's lot in life does not end up as bad as Ralph's currently is when he first meets her. I think that's interesting, but I will grant you that the themes of fatherhood are not subtle in the film and probably could have been handled better.
I won't even say that. Like, I think they're handled pretty well. It's more that I, as a person, cannot care because I'm a broken husk of a person. Other people who are not broken husk of a person would probably enjoy this and would probably get like, oh, father-daughter bonding movie, yay. Which is a good thing we should have more of in narratives, since it's usually father-son or mother-daughter. Mm-hmm. Occasionally father-daughter, never mother-son. There's How to Train Your Dragon 2, and that's it.
I do think it's interesting that they went with this sort of father-daughter narrative, though, in a ostensibly video game movie, considering how toxic masculinity can be surrounding video game culture. I think that was a interesting choice, and I do applaud them for at least doing that.
In the same way, I applaud them for having the hyper-masculine character of Calhoun be Jane Lynch and having her love interest be Felix, who's incredibly soft. This film is exploring gender roles, but I think it was exploring them as a secondary layer of narrative as opposed to a primary thing. That's okay, though. Not everything has to explore gender roles in a complicated way. It can just be a part of the narrative that isn't
remarked upon.
Sure, yeah.
I think for the most part, it works like that. I think it would have been weird if they would have gone much more into it, especially considering all the other stuff going on in the film.
100%.
Another thing I kind of like about King Candy...
Sorry, you're running a valid point, but I just keep thinking about Zangief with his thick Russian accent talking about crushing man's head like sparrow's egg between thighs. Zangief is the best. Go on with your valid point.
I do like the characterization of King Candy. He has this Mad Hatter vibe going on, and it really works for his repeated rapid character shifts and the idea that he is living a lie, since he is in fact Turbo and not actually from this game. It gives this sense of a very adult mind and personality that Turbo would probably have, considering that he has been outside of his game for years at this point.
Yeah, he's an unusual antagonist, and he's really menacing with how he has this room he can go to where he can edit the game's code. That feels like it shouldn't exist, and I'm uncomfortable with it, and seeing that have made me respect him a lot as a villain. The thing I loved about Sugar Rush was that we had all these really fun world-building things, like Laffy Taffys are vines that literally laugh at you, the cops are donuts, there's chocolate lakes and things like that, and I would have loved to see that kind of world-building applied to other worlds as well. We were talking a little bit about this, how a lot of the game cameos from real properties happens at the beginning and then we get into their own worlds. I would have kind of loved to see more of that creativity mingled with the rest of the plot. I think Sugar Rush is a fun world. I would have loved to see more of Sugar Rush and other worlds interacting with each other.
We do spend a lot of time in Sugar Rush. For the most part, the film doesn't really get going until Ralph winds up there, and it does feel a little bit unbalanced considering how much of the story is supposed to be about Ralph. We don't really spend a whole lot of time in his game compared to Sugar Rush, and we barely spend any time in Hero's Duty. I believe originally in the script, they were going to have Ralph go to a fourth game that was kind of more of a Sims Second Life social game, but they weren't quite sure how to make it work in the arcade setting.
I'm really glad they didn't do that. That sounds not good. I don't want to see Ralph in an online dating sim. Apparently the next movie is called Wreck-It Ralph Breaks the Internet. Mm-hmm. I didn't know about that until like earlier when I was looking this up, and I'm not sure that's a good idea.
I know, we'll have to see, but I don't think we should get too much into that. I think we should try and focus on this particular film.
Yeah. Speaking of this particular film, I've gushed about Calhoun at least once, but I want to talk about how every line of hers is this weird sci-fi noir nonsense. Like, she has this bit where she's like, "Flattery doesn't charge my batteries, Felix." And another part where she's like, like a mangy dog chasing a cautionary tale. And those are all fun, but also Felix will just stand there going, "What?" Whenever she says these, it lets us know that everyone else knows that these are weird, wacky things that she's saying, but that we're meant to enjoy them, not take them seriously. And I think that's a good way of transferring the narrative purpose onto a character instead of leaving it up for the audience to decide, kind of like how Quasimodo's internal experiences are externalized onto the gargoyles.
I think another strong point of this film is the humor, and a lot of it does a really good job of just landing for an all-ages audience. There's a lot of puns going on for some of the older audience members, but you also have quite a bit of slapstick and pratfalls.
And toilet humor.
Yeah, and some toilet humor.
I think that while they did manage to go for mass appeal, I kind of wish they hadn't gone quite as mass appeal-y. I think there's about two song choices used in the film, and they both feel kind of like they went with the most popular relevant song of the time. And in the same way, the plot feels kind of DreamWorks-y. It's not that those things are inherently bad, it's just that they feel like they were workshopped in a lab to try to figure out what is the most palatable way to do this. And to me, it shows. And I'm not sure that's necessarily a mark against the film or just me not being able to appreciate popular things.
Now that you do mention it, this does feel very DreamWorks-y. And for the most part, that's probably because this is pretty far outside Disney's usual wheelhouse. It's a very weird genre film. There's a lot of moving parts. There's a lot of main characters. This is a pretty sizable cast for a Disney film.
It's also dealing with themes that DreamWorks likes to get into, the inner life of a villain and how they become more heroic. You see that with Shrek, Megamind, that one movie with the giant monsters.
Oh, Monsters vs. Aliens?
Sure. Probably other examples I can't think of, but the exploring the life of a villain thing is something Disney often doesn't get into. They tend to focus on traditional heroes. I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but I am saying that it feels a little out of their wheelhouse and it feels not as Disney-esque as it could.
Their inexperience just kind of shows here.
Yeah, a little bit.
It's going to be about that time. What's moving on, Jackson?
I mean, I guess Wreck-It Ralph. I think Wreck-It Ralph is technically a better movie. It doesn't have some of the deeper problematic elements of Lady and the Tramp, but I'll admit that I'm not stoked about it. I like Wreck-It Ralph. I don't love Wreck-It Ralph.
For me, I'm also putting it down for Wreck-It Ralph. Even if you do take away all the problematic racial stuff with Lady and the Tramp. It's a very safe narrative. It's competent. It doesn't have a lot of highs or lows. Whereas Wreck-It Ralph is a lot more dynamic. There are some points that are really great and they hit pretty high. There's some parts that don't work quite as well, but I am more interested in that variance than just a C-plus static thing that Lady and the Tramp would be without all the racist stuff.
So, Wreck-It Ralph moves on. This has been another hour of feeling bad about the racism in Disney, and we'll be continuing that trend with Jungle Book next week, I assume.
Yep, we have Jungle Book and the 2009 CG Christmas Carol with Jim Carrey.
Wait, what? That counts as a Disney animated classic?
It was ranked within the top 32 Disney films.
Yep.
We set the rules for the bracket.
And it is an animated film, so it does count.
Yeah, it got in here somehow.
I'll admit, I'm kind of excited. I mean, I have not heard great things about it, but I do love A Christmas Carol. It's one of my favorite Christmas things, and I look forward to seeing how they handle it.
It'll also be interesting to see how much of next episode is not just us saying, you should watch the quote-unquote live-action Jungle Book and A Muppet Christmas Carol, as those are two better movies.
I'm not saying that that's what we should really talk about, but I am saying that in Earth 2, that's what they're watching and they're having a better time.
This is the sacrifices we make for our audience.
We do it for you. We do it for you.
So, that concludes our episode for this week. Thank you once again for listening to the Gratuitous Pausing Podcast. We'll catch you later.